supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is an incredibly common problem this time of year. What do you do with all those spring bulbs you know you should have planted in the fall? There's some really bad advice going around out there about what to do with those bulbs. We'll tell you what to do to get them to flower after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm in northeastern Oklahoma.
Very good. You know the drill. All right, what can we do for Carol in northeastern Oklahoma?
Well, I am wondering whether I can do anything to render tap water better for houseplants. It became an issue when the big box sales marked all the $15 perennials down to a dime, and I brought them all home.
Right.
Now I don't have enough standing water I collected from outside.
Right.
And I always let tap water stand overnight, but somebody told me that that was worthless, and I'm wondering if that's true.
No, it is not worthless. Now, am I correct? I'm assuming that you're trying to avoid watering your plants with city water, and you collect rainwater. Do you have a rain barrel or something like that?
Oh, yes, but we have such drought that, you know, they marked all these $15 perennials down to 10 cents, so that rain barrel water didn't last but a week.
Drought in Oklahoma? I've never heard of such a thing. Anyway, the two big problems with city water are chlorine and fluoride.
Okay.
My understanding is it's very difficult to get the fluoride out, but luckily not all plants are fluoride sensitive. Some are. Some plants will react very badly to it. But chlorine is very easy to dissolve into the atmosphere. It's easy to get out of water. And you, whoever gave you your advice was kind of approaching the correct answer. And that is to fill the container that you want with your tap water.
Mm-hmm.
Leave it sit out, preferably for 48 hours, and stir it frequently.
Okay.
And that dissipates the chlorine. The chlorine enters the atmosphere, and after 48 hours, the water will not have very much chlorine left in it at all. You will really have cleaned it up quite a bit.
Oh, great. I won a 10-cent bet.
There you go. You can go buy another perennial.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. And I wanted to tell you, you're always talking about getting those bug-eaten birds in. And I tripled the number of species I see in my yard by propping my winter bird water up against a tree trunk.
Yeah?
And all the shy birds, like the woodpeckers and the nuthatches that sometimes don't want to go to a standing bird bath, they come creeping down the tree. And, man, they're grateful for water in winter.
Oh, that is such a great idea. Yes, for people who don't know what we're talking about, I gave up seed feeding years ago, because the squirrels at my house don't need any advantage whatsoever. And I'm always worried about attracting rats and mice and voles with the spilled seed. So I feed exclusively with suet. And what I found is all of the birds that live around my house are bug-eating birds in the summertime. They're the wrens, the woodpeckers. As you say, the chickadee. The chickadee is the most ferocious bird in America. It consumes more of its own weight in insects than any other bird. That cute little fat bird, you know, is like a black panther of the avian world. And one thing I always like to add when I have enough time is feed suet in the winter. Stop feeding suet when the weather warms up, because then they'll switch over to your bugs. But do have lots of clean water out in the summertime. Well, I am going to change something I do in my garden based on this phone call. When I get home, I'm going to move my bird baths right underneath, right next to some trees. I think that is absolutely brilliant.
Well, if you put something, put your pan flush up against the bark.
Right.
And I also elevate mine a few feet to give them a chance against the cats around here.
Right. Okay, but so really, high and tight.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for a great suggestion.
Okay. Bye-bye, Mike.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tanya, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I am doing exceptionally well today, Tanya. How are you?
Great.
Oh,
just great.
And where is Tanya great?
In Nashville, Indiana. That's south central Indiana, the hilly part.
What is Nashville, Indiana like?
Nashville, Indiana is actually a little tourist place, an artsy-fartsy tourist place that we sometimes get called Little Gatlinburg.
Yeah, very interesting. So what can we do for Tanya in the other Nashville?
Wood ashes. I have a wood stove, and I use it, and I want to know what to do, what is the best thing to do with my wood ashes. I don't want to throw them out, but I don't want to put them in my garden either. Most of my plants here, the shrubs, flowers, and veggies, like this acid soil.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I grow them because of the soil. I mean, in other words, I've tried other things. They've died. These live.
Right. Right. So when you talk about your acid-loving plants and shrubs, you're talking blueberries, azaleas, rhododendrons, camellias, things like that.
Yes, exactly.
And you are exactly right. Should you put wood ashes anywhere near those plants, they'll curl up and die, because wood ashes are alkaline, which is the opposite of acidic. So when you want those acid-loving plants to thrive, some people will use sulfur. I prefer to use milled peat moss to keep the acidity of the soil nice and low. But there are uses for wood ashes. Do you have a lawn?
Well, kind of. I guess you call it that. It's green.
Well, what I suggest you do, I think Indiana, if I remember correctly, has a great state extension service.
Oh, yes, yes. Very
so
good.
Typically, in your part of the country and in my part of the country, a soil test that is done through the county extension is very inexpensive. And what you'll be looking for is your soil pH. You have a dedicated vegetable garden area?
Yes, I do.
I think we should get two soil tests done, one of which would be a mixture of soils from different parts of your vegetable garden.
Okay.
And then the other, a mixture of soil samples from your want-to-be lawn.
Okay.
Now,
okay,
you'll get the results back, and you'll get a number for your pH.
Okay.
For each of the areas. They may be different, they may not, but it's so cheap and it's so much fun. It's like getting a horoscope for your soil. Now, typically in an area like yours, where you're not out on the West Coast, you're not down in a desert, you're in a wooded area, and you get a lot of rainfall, the soil tends to be acidic. And a lawn, for instance, is going to do best with a pH of between 6.5 and 7. Now, 7 is neutral. The soil is neither acidic nor alkaline anymore. 6.5 is a little acidic. Now, with your spring-blooming plants, things like azaleas, rhododendrons, they want a very acidic soil. They want like 5.5, which is very acid. And
wow,
if you grow blueberries, for instance, they want a soil that's so acidic it'll hurt if you stick a cut finger into it. So those are the plants that you should never get wood ashes near.
Okay.
But it sounds like your vegetable garden and your lawn could use their pH raised. And that'll be on your soil test. That'll be what's called a liming recommendation. Because most people spread agricultural lime on soil to raise the pH.
Ah, but I've got the wood ashes,
which are superior to lime. You shouldn't put them on a neutral soil, but when you need to raise the pH of a soil, wood ashes do just as good a job as lime, but they also contain a lot of trace elements, a lot of phosphorus, a lot of potassium. So they are much better for your soil than lime. And the extension service will tell you exactly how many pounds of lime to add per square foot to bring your pH up. All you want to do, you want to use 1 1/3 times as much. In other words, a little more wood ash by weight than they recommend lime. If they say 5 pounds of lime, use 6 pounds of wood ashes. Also, the one crop that actually likes a sweet soil that I'm familiar with, when you're planting beans, any kind of beans, string beans, lima beans.
Yeah, I do string, yeah.
Or peas, they like a dusting of wood ash right in the trench. Peas and beans like a sweet soil. So not a lot, but that's another little side use. That's what I always save some of my wood ash to dust in with my peas and beans.
That sounds great. I'll do that, too.
All right, Tanya?
Yeah, this sounds great. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners in cold climes that the time to have your alternative de-icer on hand is before the first big ice and snow event occurs. Reject plant-killing rock salt when you go out looking, and instead get products that contain calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, potassium chloride, or similar ice melt alternatives, especially if you're going to use them near your lawn or landscape plants. But don't go saying no to rock salt just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do with those spring bulbs you should have planted, but you didn't. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll bet a good half of you out there have spring bulb guilt. You bought too many daffodils, tulips, and crocus, or you got overextended at the fall planting time, and they're sitting in a drawer somewhere, and you don't know what to do. Well, luckily for you, that's what the question of the week is about, and you'll get the answer as to what to do with your unplanted bulbs after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chuck, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Chuck, how are you, sir?
Oh, I appreciate you taking my call. Thank you.
And where is Chuck?
I'm located in Morristown, Tennessee. Up in the northeast region of Upper East Tennessee.
Is that in the Tri-Cities area?
It's just below the Tri-Cities. We're between Knoxville and Johnson City as a point of reference.
Okay.
89.5 out of Johnson City at the campus of East Tennessee University is where I listen in on.
All right, and we're thrilled to be on the air there. What can we do for you, Chuck?
Mike, I'm an administrator at a elementary school in our district, and I've decided to try to create a summer learning academy. And one of the components of that summer academy is a farming component where we're actually going to try to plant crops and then harvest those at the end of the academy and then have a festival where we sell their produce and use the proceeds for them to purchase school supplies or school clothes. I guess my question is, in our region, what types of crops am I probably looking at to be able to have a growing season and a harvest that the students could have a real hand in the growth of that?
And you have land?
Yes, about 5 acres it looks like. That's just really pasture or grassland. They mow it for hay right now.
Well, you know, that's going to be a tough conversion, Chuck.
Okay.
You know, when you've got something that's been growing grass, you know, you till it up and then you plant crops and you'll grow a lot of grass. This is still in your planning stage, right?
Yes.
I would say the first year, in other words, this coming summer, I would spend this summer actually preparing the land. I would strongly suggest you take this field and you till it up once or twice, and then you have two choices. You can level it out and water it and wait till the weeds come up. Now, anytime you till, you are uncovering and replanting literally, in a case, if I'm thinking of the size of this field, millions of weed seeds that are going to sprout. So there's two ways to defeat those seeds. One is called a stale seed bed. After you till, level, and water, you wait like 2 or 3 weeks, and then you have the kids or some volunteers go over the land with very sharp hoes, just long-handled hoes with razor-sharp heads, and they're just, without disturbing the soil, they will cut off the weeds at the soil line. And then you start off with a clean slate, what's called a stale seed bed. The other thing, which is really cool to do, but it could be expensive based on the size, is you would solarize the soil. You would till it up, you would level it out, then you would really saturate it with water, and then you would stretch sheets of clear plastic over top and let the soil cook all summer. That would get rid of any disease or any weed seeds. So you need something that grows in the off-season of the school year, June, July, and August. The first is just a one-season crop. It would be planted fresh every year, and that would be sweet corn. Sweet corn you sow when the soil temperature reaches a certain level. It grows very fast, very dramatically. The only real tending it needs over the course of a summer is some organic fertilizer, and you should be able to find some nice composted horse manure, poultry manure, where you are. Corn likes manure. That's one of the best uses for barnyard manures. And then it would be ripe in July and August. And if you staggered your planting and made sure the corn could be kept chilled, that's very important if you're selling sweet corn. It needs to be picked early in the morning before the day heats up, and then it has to be kept chilled. That's the secret to keeping the sweetness in sweet corn. So that would be a short term. Long term, if you're thinking of this being a long term project, I can't think of a better plant than blueberries.
Ah, very good.
You'd have to acidify the soil. You would have to get somebody to donate, or you'd have to somehow cop a whole bunch of milled peat moss, because you'd need to bring that soil down to the pH of a peat bog. And then, of course, you'd have to buy the plants. And it takes 3 or 4 years for blueberry bushes to get to a size where they're really bearing and they're really putting on blueberries. And you can either buy young plants and wait, or you can spend a little bit more money or find a more generous person and buy really established plants and start picking the second or third year. But that's the reality of any kind of growing. Corn, sweet corn, is fast and easy. You can get it in, you can get it out in the summer. That's when it grows. Anything else, any of the kind of festival-type fruits that come to mind, blueberries are an easy grow as long as you protect them from birds who will fight you for every berry, and you keep the soil acidified, but you need time to get the plants up to size. And
right.
With blueberries, the work is in the picking. It takes quite a while to pick blueberries, but they travel really well. They handle really well. You don't need a lot of skill to do it, and it's very satisfying work. And again, who wouldn't come for fresh blueberries or for a blueberry festival?
That's what we were thinking, is if the festival could be something like, with the music aspect, a bluesberry, so that would work out perfect.
Just remember, anytime you grow fruit like that, you're really growing for the future.
Okay, very good, very good.
All right, Chuck?
Thank you very much, Mike.
Good luck, sir, and keep on listening.
All right, thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Susan. How are you?
Just fine.
And where is Susan Fine?
Middletown, Delaware.
What can we do for Susan in Delaware?
You know, I am looking into trying to get row covers to cover, you know, cabbages and broccoli so I can get them out sooner for my, you know, spring garden before the bugs come out.
Right.
And I had been reading things about using electrical conduit to make the metal hoops.
Right.
And I wanted to make sure someone told me, I asked my husband, he's a chemist, and he's like, oh, it's just zinc, it's fine, you don't have to worry about it getting into your beds. So I was just curious, is that what you've heard? You know, who can I check to find out to really make sure that I'm using the right thing? Someone else had suggested using water-grade PVC, and I feel much better with metal than the plastic, you know?
Okay, PVC, I am totally against.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Polyvinyl chloride, I got in trouble. A listener did not agree with my interpretation, but as far as I'm concerned, it's like solid bleach.
Yeah, right.
What people don't realize about the PVC is it leaches out in an acid environment. And most of our gardens, the soil tends towards the acidic. The last thing you want in organic gardening is to introduce polyvinyl chloride. Now, let's go back a little bit, because the issue of row covers or the use of row covers is a fine idea. Row covers are blankets, rolls of spun polyester fabric that you stretch across crops. The blanket is porous enough to let in air, water, and all the sunlight that the plants need. But it provides a physical barrier against pests, and also at the beginning and the end of the season, it traps heat underneath and keeps the plants and the soil around the plants warmer. Now, some people just, you know, to protect their plants against frost, they will just drape these blankets, these spun polyester row covers, over top of their plants. But the smart money puts metal hoops in the ground and then puts the blanket over top of the hoops and really digs the edges into the soil. If you buy a kit for this.
Right. I've been looking at different catalog companies that offer things. And one of the reasons I actually work at an organic garden at a school, which is kind of that's where I'm doing most of this, but I'm doing a little bit at home. And the organic garden at the school, they've kind of had different things going on. But for us, I think it would make more sense, since most everything grows in the summer, to have it during the winter when we can have these lettuces and the other things that they could actually eat during the school year.
Oh, I think if you have a school garden, absolutely making these little hoop houses, making these row covers, that's really bringing the gardening season into the school year. I think that's an
right.
Absolutely great idea. Now, your husband says that the electrical conduit is...
Yeah, he just told me it's zinc coating.
Is
and
like
I'm
zinc
like...
coated. That's not the ideal situation either. You know, these things are very inexpensive. Typically, they come with stainless steel hoops.
Okay, so stainless steel?
Yeah, and they're already the right size.
All
and a complete row cover mini hoop kit. We'll have the fabric. We'll have, the bendable hoops so that you can suspend it. And it'll probably also come with little metal pins
right.
that you use to push down the sides.
Right.
You want to just stick with the small scale stuff for the backyard, for the backyard gardener. And especially if you're doing it for the first time, buy the complete kit. Buy the hoops and the pins and the fabric. And do it that way the first year. Then, if you feel confident, then you can start making your own after that.
Right.
All right, Sis?
I very much appreciate it. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Good luck.
All right. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carla, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Carla. Where are you?
Beaufort, North Carolina.
Well, what can we do you for?
I have a worm box that my son gave me for Christmas a year ago. And he seeded it with worms from his box that he had had for a year. And they have thrived, and there's lots and lots of them. And it's been great. It's sitting on it's a closed-in porch.
Mm-hmm.
But the last 2 months, we are being inundated by gnats. And I don't know why... now, if there's something that I'm doing wrong in the management that has made this change, my husband is very, he insists that it's that and not his wine that he's making that's drawing them.
Oh, is he also making wine out on the porch?
No, the wine is actually under the stairs in the middle of the house.
And the fruit flies are all over that, like a new suit, right?
Well, it's sealed. He has airlocks on them.
Right.
And they don't seem to be in there, but they're just generally all over the house. They're even upstairs.
Is it red wine that he's making?
He makes all kinds. He's
okay.
made wine out of aloe and pear.
Really? Aloe wine?
Yeah.
So if you burn your throat, that's like you do 2 glasses of that, you know?
I guess.
Okay, so the basics of a worm bin are you put in your non-meat kitchen garbage, and
right.
you always make sure there's a lot of bedding, which most of us use shredded black and white newsprint for.
Mm-hmm.
Are you
I've
using
got a
bedding?
Lot of I might be too short on the bedding. It might disappear faster than I'm realizing.
Yes, they do use up a lot more bedding than I realized. I have a worm bin as well. And it's funny, mine is on an enclosed porch as well. And now recently, we also had a problem with fruit flies. I found out accidentally how to control them. And it's funny you mention your husband's wine, because I was drinking red wine and let my glass sit out. And I... went back to it half an hour later. I took a sip and I did an Uncle Tanoose. I spit it out. I could tell there was something. And I looked and there were like 100 dead fruit flies in the wine. First, I'll leave it out in a little dish and hundreds of them will fly to their doom. Then the smart ones stay behind. When you get to the bottom of a bottle of wine, you leave like, 3 fingers worth of wine.
Right.
Red wine in the bottom of the bottle, you put it right where you have your fruit fly problem. They fly in because they're tremendously attracted to the red wine, but they can't fly back out again because of the narrow neck of the bottle. So if you leave a bottle of red wine with like a couple of inches of wine in the bottom right next to your worm bin, all of the fruit flies will fly to their death.
Okay. Well, I had heard somewhere that if you put vinegar with a drop of dishwashing liquid, like in a cup or a bowl,
yes,
that they come to that. And I have had that sitting in the kitchen, and it does attract them.
If you have as many as it sounds like, I would do 3 things. So you leave out a couple of these wine bottles. You leave out a couple of your vinegar traps. And then one thing I also learned accidentally is sticky traps, the kind of traps that people use for white flies in greenhouses or in flea traps, where it's a very sticky material. If you mm-hmm. just put that in the area where they're landing, they land on that and they can't get off. So between the three of those, you get a very quick knockdown. And then over a period of a couple of days, you get rid of the stragglers. But what happened is, you know, fruit flies are ubiquitous. In your climate, they are outside right now. And
right.
so if you have a little bit of exposed fruit, if you've got apples sitting out on your counter or mangoes or bananas, they can actually come in from the outside or they can come in on a fresh piece of fruit and then they'll get established and they'll start breeding. So it's nobody's fault. Nobody did anything wrong. I doubt that the worm bin would be guilty only if you put a piece of fruit in there that already had fruit flies on it. And yes, making sure there's a lot of that shredded newspaper for bedding, that smothers the fruit. You always want to make sure any fresh garbage in your worm bin is completely covered by bedding.
Okay.
That's a great way to prevent any kind of fruit flies from getting established near the worm bin. But sometimes in the kitchen around fresh fruit in the compost crock, it's just going to happen. But the three traps will get rid of them.
Okay. Well, that's great.
All right, Carla. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn listeners far and wide that my springtime tour will soon begin. I'll open the season at the Rockville, Maryland Community Home Show on Saturday, February 9th, appear at the Upper Dublin Public Library on Monday, February 18th, that's President's Day, at 7 p.m., and then at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA, Friday through Sunday, February 22nd through the 24th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do with those spring bulbs you should have planted months ago. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, what you should and shouldn't do with those spring bulbs that you certainly should have planted back between Halloween and Thanksgiving. We'll tell you how to save them at the 11th hour after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Jim in Flemington, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Jim in the Garden State?
Well, compost. I listened to your show about compost, and I have probably a pretty typical suburban vegetable garden. Other than put it on my front lawn, I've got one place that gets lots of sun, so I plant that one place year after year. And I try to amend the soil by adding leaves and compost. The problem I've had is that I got my compost from a municipal site.
Yeah.
And a farmer warned me that I would be hit with terrible weeds, and she was right. I got horrible weeds, so I abandoned that. I'm at the point where I'd like to get a truckload of compost, and mm-hmm. But I don't know how to put it down. Do I just lay it on top like icing on a cake and plant it, or do I have to dig it into the soil? And
when,
if so, how deep should it be?
Well, when you're talking about your weed situation, did you till your garden?
No, I just put it on top.
You just put it on top, so then the compost did have weed seeds in it. Did you go back and tell them?
I didn't go back, no.
Yes, because they need to hear that. That simply means they didn't heat it up enough. And when you're a municipal composting site, you're supposed to be paying attention. You're supposed to be taking temperature readings. And with the kind of bulk that they use, there's really no excuse for them not heating it up enough to kill weed seeds. I've used a lot of municipal composts from many different sources, and I've never had that problem. But the basic answers to your question are the best composts are yard waste compost. The weed issue should not recur. I would talk to them if you're going to go to the same place. I don't know if you have access to another municipal composting site. But we're also going to tell you how you can make the weed problem not a problem anyway. The best thing for a raised bed garden that you're not walking in, especially so you're not compacting the soil, is, yes, you just put the compost on the surface of your raised beds, and the perfect depth is 2 inches. Now, if the compost is warm when you get it, sometimes people will buy aged mushroom soil, which is not synonymous with compost, but they kind of know each other, and it'll still be a little warm. What you're supposed to do is spread that on your raised beds and then just let it sit for a couple of weeks before you put little plants in it or sow seeds in it so that a little bit of the nitrogen dissipates. I think we can be protective of your garden by you doing the same thing no matter what your source of compost. Get a big bulk load of compost, spread it out on your beds to a depth of 2 inches, level it, water it, and then wait 10 days. At the end of 10 days, any weed seeds that were in the compost will have sprouted. And that's when you just take a very sharp hoe and you just slice just at the very top of the soil line, just glide right over the top of the soil. There's some really well-designed, super sharp hoes out there. I can't remember the name of the one I use, but it's almost like a single-edged razor blade, and it's really sharp on both sides, and it's perfect for this technique, which is called a stale seed bed. You deliberately let any weed seeds germinate, then you slice them off at the soil line. And it may sound too simple, too good to be true, but you've just eliminated 95% of any weeds that are going to show up that year. And if you do this, if you level out your compost, you water it, you wait a week or 10 days and nothing comes up, then that shows you that this was an exceptionally good batch that got heated up enough to kill the weed seeds. Bulk compost should pass the duck test. It should look like rich black soil. It should smell like good earth, and it should feel like rich topsoil. And if it smells right, if it's the right color, if it feels good, then it's a duck, and it is exactly the right stuff to use. If it seems a little warm, then you should wait a week or two before planting in it.
I will do that.
All right, man?
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you for asking about compost. It's our double favorite topic here.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you today?
I am doing very well, Chris. How are you?
Good. I'm good.
Where is Chris good?
I'm in Manistee, Michigan, which is the northern half of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan.
What can we do for Chris in Michigan?
We had a problem some years ago, maybe 8 years ago, with carpenter ants. We found some damage in our garage, And my husband, between the concern with carpenter ants and also a concern with spiders, which he was a bit on the arachnophobic side. Anyway, he got a guy to come and start doing the around the perimeter of the house type spraying four times a year. And when I was listening to, I think it was the last show that I heard, my concerns were heightened in terms of the environment with doing that kind of spraying. So my question is there another alternative that would work to, especially to be sure that the carpenter ants aren't attacking our house? Or, you know, what do we do that's environmentally reasonable?
You cancel the spraying. And then you go buy yourself something nice with the money you're saving from not poisoning yourself four times a year, because the dangers are zero. The thing most people don't understand about carpenter ants, and carpenter ants almost instill the same level of fear in people as termites, but they are very different creatures. Yes, they both process cellulose. They both, quote, feast on wood. But the big difference is termites and carpenter bees will chew into sound wood. Carpenter ants will not touch a piece of good wood. If you see carpenter ants, they are doing you a favor. They're a flashing light telling you you have a severe moisture problem that has caused the wood to become rotten, and it's becoming structurally unsound. They're only attracted to wood that is already rotting away. And I'm even guessing you can think back and remember that there was a water problem in your garage where you found the carpenter ants the first time.
Not that we were aware of. In our house is only about 15 years old, and this was 6 to 8 years ago.
Any wood can be water damaged, and that is the only type of wood that carpenter ants attack. Now, if your husband is super concerned, boric acid is the non-toxic treatment for any kind of ants. It also works against termites. Typically, with regular kitchen ants or household ants, you buy a boric acid bait that's a very low dose of boric acid mixed with a sweetener because those ants go for sweetness. A lot of times in areas where there's dampness or there's a big threat of termites, people during the construction of a house will insert borate-treated rods. Now, I know that sounds like a nuclear device or anything, but all borate means boron, the element boron,
which
is in boric acid. And what they do is they put a low dose of boric acid into these wooden rods and just insert it into the lumber. He can go out and buy borate-treated dowels, drill holes in whatever walls he's concerned about, slide them in, and then if any carpenter ants or termites come, they would chew on that. The poison acts so slowly, they take it back to the colony and they kill the queen. It's really not going to be an issue. They're not going to come until there's rotten wood. And again, anytime you have rotten wood, it's a mitzvah when an ant comes and tells you that you got a problem in your house.
I hear you. Yeah.
And the spiders are not a threat. Spiders are totally carnivorous. They consume other pests. Spiders are a great defense against ticks, mosquitoes, fleas, flies, true pests. Spiders are the only predator that actually kills more than they consume. And almost all the studies have shown that when exterminators are called in to kill spiders, there is an increase in true pests in the house. That's when the fleas and the flies and all the other real problems show up. Whether he likes it or not, the only poisonous spider you have in your area is the black widow. Even that doesn't want to bite you. And the biggest exposure is when people stick bare hands into firewood outside, something like that, where they startle the spider.
So, oh, yeah. Okay.
the spiders we see inside a house, a wolf spider, you know, something like that, they are the little exterminators, and they're working for free, and they're not spraying around any nerve toxins.
Right. I gotcha. Okay.
All right, Chris.
Thank you. That helps.
Oh.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure. We always like to talk about carpenter ants.
Okay.
Take care.
Have a good day.
You too. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Wintertime choices for spring bulb procrastinators. Larry Roebling, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read off this week's questions, s'il vous plaît.
Carol in Glenmore, Pennsylvania writes, "Help! I bought 100 daffodil bulbs but only got 60 planted. What do I do besides not ordering so many bulbs next year? Can I save the remaining 40 bulbs? If I plant them outdoors in early spring, will they bloom later that spring? Do I store them in a refrigerator in the meantime?" And Dick in Medford Lakes writes, "I just picked up a bunch of fall bulbs from a garden center that was going to throw them out. The ground is too hard to plant them now. Can I put them in the freezer until next fall? Or should I plant them in pots filled with sterile mix for summer bloom?" Finally, we also heard from Kristen in Reading, Pennsylvania. She writes, "I read an article in my local newspaper that said it's okay to keep bulbs like tulips and daffodils in the freezer over the winter and plant them outside in the spring. What do you think about this? Thanks for your advice."
Well, I think that putting naked bulbs or even bulbs in pots into a freezer would be a very bad idea. That so-called garden writer should have his or her hand smacked with an ornamental allium. As our resident bulb expert, Art Walk, winner of countless Philadelphia Flower Show blue ribbons and author of Bulb Forcing for the Beginner and Seriously Smitten, has explained many times, you have to adhere to a very tight temperature range when you're trying to trick spring bulbs into believing that they're really outside in the ground. The ideal range, says Art, is 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Quite a distance from the zero Fahrenheit that most freezers are set for. Now, this basic question, what do I do with the spring bulbs I should have planted outside between Halloween and Thanksgiving, now that it's after New Year's, is a very common one. And Art's basic answer is generally to try to plant them outside anyway. Says Artsky, if the ground isn't frozen solid, it's much easier to try and get them into bloom by planting them directly in the garden. Yeah, even this late in the game. With any luck, they should flower just a little bit behind fall-planted bulbs. Art says he's occasionally had leftover daffodils and tulips that he's planted directly in the garden, not in pots, as late as January 20th, and they've bloomed just fine. But what about pots, I asked Art. As I mentioned on the show last fall, I deliberately planted 5 pots of bulbs in a soil-free mix and perlite, saturated them really well with water, let them drain, and then put them in a beer fridge we have in the basement that stays right around 45 degrees. I even dated them and specified the variety so I'd know when they had chilled long enough. That's 10 weeks for little bulbs like crocus, 12 to 14 weeks for bigger ones like tulips and daffodils. I didn't need to do this. I got plenty of outdoor space. But one, it seemed like a really fun thing to try. And two, I could at least delay the inevitable evil squirrel attack on my poor plants. My plan is to bring some of the pots into bright lights indoors when their chilling time has been achieved and display them that way, and then to take the others outside to a prominent location when their correct number of weeks has gone by. If I get the timing and temperature right, I expect them all to behave like plants that were always outdoors and bloom nicely for me. The only disadvantage of potting up and chilling forgotten bulbs, says Art, is the extra time and effort it takes. You have to have enough pots, enough soil-free mix, and the proper place to give them that all-important 40 to 50 degrees for root formation and flower stem extension. He adds that if you have the pots in the mix but not an extra fruit-free fridge, you can't force bulbs in a fridge where fruits will also be stored, you can bury the pots outside with the lip of the pot flush with the soil line. Now, I really like this idea. It's much easier to dig one big hole in cold to frozen soil than a couple dozen little ones. Then when spring arrives, you can just leave them there in the ground, or you can move the pots to a more visible area for better display right before their flowers open up. So, just how late in the game can you do this kind of thing, I asked Art. Say you notice you have unplanted bulbs in, say, April. Can you pot them up, chill them down, and have tulips blooming in July? Not outdoors, says Art. The summer heat in most regions would prevent the flowers from emerging, a condition known as blindness. Or if they somehow managed to emerge, the bud wouldn't develop into a good blossom, a condition known as bud blast. So get going, all you bulb procrastinators out there. It sounds like once you pass a certain point in the season, an old bulb is good for the compost pile and nothing else. Well, that sure was some interesting information about saving your unplanted spring bulbs at the 11th hour now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over at your leisure. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put fruit in my fridge if I don't get out of this studio. She's so mean to me. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line or your email may not make it to us. And check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook, where we post new content every day or pretty much close to it. Elizabeth Perez Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Don't Call Me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Larry Roebling continues to do a chilling job as our substitute producer, while Alexis Landis, who normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, continues her maternity leave, or as we like to call it, sleepless since September. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, hasn't slept well since 1997. Currently dozing off is our production assistant, Brett Rader. It's always a bad idea to wake up our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm wide awake, Mike McGrath, but I'll cut back on the caffeine a little bit so I don't scare the children so much when I see you next week. A common houseplant pest this time of year is the mealybug. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to safely do away with these waxy-covered plant pests, plus your fabulous phone calls.